Shalom, welcome to ASJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chasdai, Pesach Ben Dov, Meir Ben Yecheskel, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers this week, the negotiations for Israeli national suicide have started. And Barack Hussein Obama and John Kerry, the two anti-Semites who want to destroy Israel, have set a 9-month deadline for the negotiations to conclude, for there to be an agreement for national suicide. They've set a 9-month deadline. However, if there is no end to the negotiations at the end of the 9 months, Obama and Kerry have stated that they intend to present a United States plan for so-called peace. In other words, at the end of the 9 months, Obama and Kerry are promising that they're going to have the United States present a plan that will be supported by Europe and the rest of the world to impose upon Israel a so-called peace plan. Now, of course, we already know what the Obama-Kerry plan will entail. Israel would have to retreat to the pre-1967 suicide borders that are only 6 to 9 miles wide, which is complete insanity. Israel can never defend herself in borders that are 6 to 9 miles wide when she's outnumbered 100 to 1 by a 500 million Arab and Iranian Muslim Nazis that surround her. There's no way, outnumbered 100 to 1 with the whole world against her, this tiny Jewish state can survive in borders that are 6 to 9 miles wide. That's why even Abba Ibn, an extreme leftist, referred to those borders as Auschwitz lines, Holocaust lines, suicide lines. And of course, this would be to create a so-called Palestinian state, even though there are no Palestinians, there is no Palestine. That's all an Arab lie, an Arab bluff. Will Netanyahu, when presented with the Obama-Kerry suicide plan, will he reject the plan and resist U.S. pressure when the whole world is brutally squeezing him to accept this, when even the Israeli news media and the Israeli elites are telling him we have no choice, we've got to accept it, we've got to depend upon Obama now for our survival? When Netanyahu comes under this massive pressure from the United States, from Barack Hussein Obama, who never has to run for re-election again, so he doesn't care now, he could put on all the brutal pressure that he wants. When Netanyahu faces this brutal, massive international pressure and internal pressure as well from the left-wing Israeli news media, from the left-wing Israeli elites, from the Israeli billionaires and the owners of multinational corporations who are Israelis, and they all start demanding that he accept this, do you think he's going to be strong enough to stand up to this pressure? What is his history? When he comes under pressure, he always has caved in the past. So there's a very great danger here, a very great danger here, that this will eventually come true and that this disaster will occur. In fact, in Israel, many of the elites and many of the media people and others have already said it's inevitable that there's going to be a Palestinian state. You can't stop it. It's inevitable that Israel is going to go back to the pre-1967 borders. It's just a matter of time. God forbid. They could be right, which is why we have to do everything we can to try to stop it. Now, of course, our goal and our objective with our very limited budget and a situation where I'm not allowed to even step foot in Israel with all of these severe limitations, we're still trying our best and working day and night to try to prevent this catastrophe. We're trying to wake up Israeli Jews and we're trying to wake up Americans in order to build resistance and opposition to the suicide plan, because the more opposition there is, the more resistance there is, the better a chance we have of preventing this and of defeating this. We are also, of course, working to shore up and strengthen and give backbone to the political opposition to this in Israel. There are people, many members of the Likud, that don't want this to happen. Most Likud voters would be strongly against this. Most of the people who actually vote for the Likud being the ruling party in Israel, and many Likud Knesset members are against it. The majority of Likud Knesset members are actually against this, but I don't know under pressure what they would do because they're political prostitutes. And so we're keeping the pressure on in terms of Likud members, in terms of the Jewish Home Party members. We're keeping the pressure on, and we're doing the best we can together with others to pressure these individuals to make sure that they counter the pressure on Netanyahu, that Netanyahu receives pressure from them not to agree to this insanity, not to agree to this suicidal retreat. And there are people in Israel that are trying to pressure Netanyahu not to agree. We are just one out of many groups that is doing this in terms of political pressure. We're adding our voice to this with our videos and with our messages and with people in our Hebrew Forum and others in Israel writing to people, contacting people, constantly trying to wake people up. We're trying to add to the atmosphere of political pressure. We're not the only ones, not on this issue. On this issue, there are others who agree that this is a catastrophe. But we're one of the groups that's trying to add our voice to this and trying to do the best we can to prevent this. If our best efforts to politically prevent this by pressuring Netanyahu and saying to Netanyahu, you're going to lose your prime ministership and this is insane and you can't agree to this, if we fail to stop this through political pressure, or if God doesn't save, that God could miraculously save the Jewish people from this, all types of events can occur in the Middle East that could miraculously save Israel from this. But we know from history that we can't depend on miracles like that, because sometimes God will go through with this and will allow us to be in this situation in order to test us and maybe also in order to punish us, God forbid. That's a possibility. We could be facing divine punishment now for all the evil things that unfortunately so many Jews have done. So we can't take lightly the threat here. And we can't depend upon a miracle from God, because a miracle from God to stop it may not come. We can't depend on miracles. We pray for miracles. We pray for God to have pity and mercy on the Jewish people and on the world and not to allow this terrible thing to happen, but we can't depend on that. So if all of our best efforts don't work, God forbid, and if Netanyahu agrees with the PLO terrorists, they come into an agreement and they accept some U.S. plan that Obama and Kerry come up with. If that happens, God forbid, then the only hope is mass resistance. Huge numbers of Israeli Jews, especially Israeli Jewish youth, must be willing to go to the areas that are supposed to be destroyed, the Jewish communities that would be destroyed and the Jews that would be expelled, as many tens of thousands of Jews have to go there and have to block the expulsion and the retreat with their bodies. This happened once before in Amona. What we have advocated for years happened once before in Amona in 2006. And the people in Amona who did resist, who did fight back, were brutally beaten by the police. Many of them had to be hospitalized. They were brutally beaten. We've shown you videos of this in English and in Hebrew. And it was a terrible, terrible bloody mess. But the people of Israel, seeing this heroic resistance, turned against any further retreats. Overwhelmingly, the people of Israel said, we don't want any more of this. We want this to stop. The people of Israel don't have the stomach for this. If there's going to be this type of Amona-like resistance every time they go to expel Jews, the people of Israel do not have the stomach for this and will overwhelmingly tell their leaders, we don't want this anymore. And so this can be stopped through mass resistance. We hope we don't get to that point, because we don't know if the people of Israel are going to be willing to do the mass resistance. We don't know. The Yesha Council, who are the establishment hacks, the establishment traitors, phonies, and fifth columnists in Judea and Samaria, who are paid for by the government and who provide budgets to the various towns and communities in Judea and Samaria, these people who are funded by the government, they're going to try to do what they did in Gush Katif. They're going to try to destroy any possible opposition and create an ineffective opposition and tell people, let's have big demonstrations against this in Tel Aviv, which is worthless, or in Jerusalem, which is worthless, instead of going to the areas which are slated for expulsion and resisting there, which is what can stop it. So we're going to have a huge battle on our hands trying to convince enough Jews to resist. There will be there will be Jews who will also say that we have to resist. We won't be the only ones saying this if God forbid this emergency comes. There will be other Jews who will say this. But we're going to be one of those important voices. We were an important voice in Gush Katif, but people didn't listen to us. We were the voice that said, you've got to do this in Gush Katif. If people had listened to us, we could have stopped the Gush Katif's expulsion, and we could have stopped the surrender of Gaza. And we wouldn't be in this situation today. But we will be one of the voices that will speak up, one of the voices, so when you support JTF, you're supporting one of those voices that will speak up and that will be uncompromising. And we'll be pushing everybody else to the right as best as we can with our limited budget. In the meantime, of course, we're opposing and resisting attempts to freeze Jewish building in any area of Judea and Samaria. We want to move as many Jews in there as possible, because the more Jews that are there and the more communities that exist there and the more infrastructure you have there, the more difficult it is to carry out an expulsion and to create a so-called Palestine state. Those are just what we call facts on the ground. Those are facts that create a new reality. If you had 1 million Jews, for instance, living there, it would be almost impossible to create a Palestine state. But you've got about 300,000 Jews, maybe 350,000. 350,000 Jews, actually. And only about 100,000 who live in the areas that would be slated for expulsion. About 250,000, as we've explained in the past, would not actually be expelled. They would be living in areas that are right on the border, close to the border, the 3-5% of Judea and Samaria that Israel would keep in a negotiated settlement, God forbid. So only about 100,000 Jews would actually be slated for expulsion. And that is very doable, unless there's mass resistance. Israel can carry that out. They can do it. And so we've got to do everything we can to put as many Jews, especially in those areas, as possible, and to build up political resistance. And I'll give you an example of something that we've done this past week that we were involved with. We weren't the only group, we were one of many groups that protested this. There was a demonstration, in fact, in Beit El, and people protested, and members of the Knesset spoke out because they received a lot of complaints about this. But one of the things that we protested was the decision to use stun guns. The police acted like a bunch of Nazis. Israeli police acted like Nazis. Went in with stun guns to the home of Boaz Albert. Boaz Albert is a Jewish hero in Yitzhar, a great Jewish community in Shomron, in Samaria. And Boaz Albert has gotten an order that he's not allowed to live in his home. He has to live in pre-67 Israel. He's not allowed to live in Shomron, in Samaria. He's gotten an order that he's, even though he lives there for years, he has a family there, he has children there, he's not allowed to live with his family. He's been expelled by court order, because they feel that he will be one of the people who will be resisting their plan to throw the Jews out. So they just issued a Bolshevik court order, Stalinist court order, to expel him from his home. He refused to abide by the expulsion order. He went back to his home and said, I'm not abiding by it, I'm not going to accept it. So the police came to arrest him, and they grabbed him. He was not resisting. They could have grabbed him and dragged him out. He lay on the floor. He says, I'm not leaving. They picked him up. He was not resisting, though, physically. It was just civil disobedience. What Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi and all these other leftists in history that were always applauded by everybody, he did the same thing Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi did. He's laying on the floor and he says, I'm not leaving. You have to take me out. You'll have to take me out physically. I'm not voluntarily walking out with you. So they pulled out stun guns, very powerful police stun guns, and they electrocuted him with those stun guns over and over again. It's very painful. And they gave him electric shock with those stun guns over and over again in the presence of his little children. We have a video that we showed you. We did a video on this where we show you his little babies are crying. I mean, it's in Hebrew, but you could see, you hear children crying. His wife is screaming. And he has a couple of his neighbors there who were trying to defend him. His neighbors are speaking out. But he was repeatedly given electric shock treatment with a stun gun by the police, sadistically, even though he wasn't resisting. This is the type of Nazi behavior that we've come to expect from the sadists in the Israeli police. The Israeli Bolshevik police are sadistic, they're corrupt, they're evil, and they follow evil orders gladly. They hate their fellow Jews, and they're just sadists. Anyway, we did a video on this, and we've been writing to people and protesting and going all over the internet. And, you know, we tried to do something to raise consciousness on this issue. Other people also did get involved. The people in Yitzhar, in this Jewish community, got very involved, and other people in Shomron and Samaria, they got very involved. And so we weren't the only voice, fortunately. And guess what? Because people spoke out, because we woke people up, because this was publicized, the police announced they're not going to use stun guns, at least for now, that they're going to investigate whether or not they should be using stun guns in the future. They announced they're no longer going to use stun guns. They're freezing that, they said. Under pressure from the public, because the public became aware of this and people were horrified to see the film of this. We did a video, and other videos were also done on this. Now, I don't know how much we influenced things. I think that other people actually had a bigger influence than we did. But we added our voice. We added our voice. There were people who didn't know about this, who wrote and said in response to what we was writing on the internet and in response to our video. I mean, people have said, you know, we didn't know, and in response to what we publicized on our Facebook page, on our Facebook pages. People said, we didn't know this, boy, we didn't know this happened. Whoa, what Nazi behavior. What a bunch of Bolsheviks. So we did, you know, we spread the word. I think we increased the pressure. And that's what we're doing. We're not always the main voice in some of these protests, because the reason we're not the main voice is because our budget is so small. If our budget was bigger, we'd become the main voice. Unfortunately, we're not the main voice. If we were the main voice, we'd be in better shape, because our voice is effective and our voice is uncompromising. And we've been right on these issues over and over again, more than anyone else. But unfortunately, most of the time, our voice is not even the main voice when there's protests like this. We're just one of the secondary voices. Because we don't have the money to be a main voice. But I still think it helps. I think every extra voice and every extra video and all the posts on our Facebook pages in Hebrew and all the things our Hebrew forum did and all the noise that we made on the internet about this, I think it helps. I think it added to the general sense of alarm and anger and protest, and I think it added to the pressure on political leaders. I think it helps. Some of our people in Israel wrote to Knesset members who responded and looked and investigated. I think it helps. So we're doing the best we can. If you agree that this is important, if you agree that we're not allowed to be silent, none of us are allowed to be silent, then JTF is the organization for you, because you know that at least with us, we will always consistently, uncompromisingly keep trying. On every major issue facing the survival of Israel, we will keep trying to wake people up, to raise our voice, to convince people, to do everything we can to stop this insanity. At least with us, you know that that's going to happen. And I think we've played a role over the years. I think we have. I think we've accomplished things and played a role. It isn't anywhere near enough. It's nowhere near enough. Because we don't have enough funds. What are we going to do? We don't have enough funds. But we are trying our best. And even if we don't have enough money to take over the government and do all the wonderful things we'd like to do and really redeem the Jewish people right now, which is what our dream is, even if we can't do that, with our limited budget, we got to do whatever we can do. Whatever we can do, we have to do. Whatever we can do to try our best, we have to do. We won't always succeed, but we always must try. And by the way, even if you fail, when you do something good, even if you seemingly fail, it counts. God counts it. And in the future, it may lead to successes on other things. God may intervene in the future. It adds credit, positive credit. zchuyot, rights and credit and merit to the struggle to save Israel. God does take it into account. It's like when you have a prayer that isn't answered. And you say, I prayed for this a million times and it's never been answered. Your prayers were never wasted. Even if you pray your whole life and you go to the next world and you know you pass away, go to the next world, and your prayers were seemingly never answered. Those prayers were not wasted. Because what you prayed for will be answered in a different way. If it was a good prayer and it was for something good, it'll be answered in a different way some other time, maybe in the future. When you do good things, a loving God does not ignore that. You may not see the results right away. You may not even see it in your lifetime. But a loving God does count everything we do. A loving God gives us credit for every good thing we do. And so we must try our best and we must speak out. We must be a voice of uncompromising truth. Because someday, uncompromising truth will be what redeems the world. And so I urge you to help us. Get involved with us and help us. When we put up English and Hebrew videos, as we did again this week, as we did again, in fact, last night, when we put up the English and Hebrew videos, help us promote these videos on YouTube and on Facebook. Like, favorite, comment, share, and mirror the videos. Also help us on our Facebook pages. We've got at least three Facebook pages in English, at least two in Hebrew. Help us on those pages to make the pages interesting and inviting so more people get involved. Thousands and thousands of people, out of curiosity, come to those Facebook pages and read them. They read them and influencing thousands of people can help. Those thousands of people have friends and relatives and other people they speak to. It can help. You never know what that can lead to. It certainly can't hurt. And the same thing on our English and Hebrew forums. As you can see in our statistics, you see the statistics on our forums. Thousands of people visit our English and Hebrew forums every day. And so, you know, out of curiosity, because they see we have so many videos on YouTube that thousands of people visit those forums. And so make the forums an inviting place, a convincing place. Help convince people. Put up threads and posts that are persuasive and that invite people to join with us and make people want to join with us and make people want to become part of the cause. And finally, most of all, of course, our big downfall is our lack of money. Checks, money orders, cash donations made to our post office box make a big difference. Every check, money order, and cash donation makes a big difference. It helps us. It helps us reach more people. It helps us do more convincing. It helps. And the same thing is true for people who help us with their credit cards, go to the donate button on our main pages and click on the donate buttons on JTF.org and on Hayamin.org. There's a donate button on top. They click there, and with their credit cards, they make donations. It makes a difference. It helps. God bless the wonderful JTFers who are helping us generously on a regular basis so that we could do what has to be done. Because we're going to keep fighting for what's right. We're going to keep fighting for justice. And God willing, I hope and pray that we can wake enough people up in time to prevent a catastrophe from occurring, or maybe to persuade God to have mercy on us and miraculously save the Jewish people and the world once again from the insanity of our own leaders. God willing. And now, let's move on to the questions from our great JTFers. Okay. I know I went on a long time here. Oh, I really did go on a long time in this opening, but I thought it was important. We'll start out with the great Hollywood is a dreamland for Marx and Lenin, who writes, and I quote, please discuss the following celebrities, in quotes. And here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 8 celebrities, all of whom are, I could see all of whom are the scum of the earth. Okay, let's go through them as quickly as possible. Roman Polanski. Okay, Roman Polanski is an absolute vile individual, the lowest of the low. I don't remember. I know that his father was Jewish, And his father was a self-hating Jew. I think his mother was half and half. I don't know which half. Anyway, he's an atheist. He's just an evil atheist. In 1977, by the way, he's a Hollywood producer and he produces movies like Rosemary's Baby. In 1977, this sick pedophile pervert had sex with a 13-year-old girl. He was arrested in Los Angeles for having sex with a 13-year-old girl. He fled to France, where he's a citizen, so they couldn't extradite him. All the Hollywood executives and actors defended him, which is proof of the fact, by the way, that in addition to homosexual marriage and all these other perverted things that you see being legitimized now, they're going to legitimize pedophilia too. This is proof of the fact. Roman Polanski was a pedophile. He had sex with a 13-year-old girl, and all the Hollywood actors and executives and all the who's who of Hollywood were all defending him. So that's Roman Polanski, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro. Now George Clooney, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro. Oh, what a vicious left-wing Jew hater. He's constantly urging the United States to increase pressure on Israel to commit suicide. He's a member of the Jew-Hating Council on Foreign Relations. He's just a vicious left-wing Jew-hater. Alan Rickman, who, by the way, despite his name, is not Jewish. Alan Rickman is 100% not Jewish. He produced the Jew-Hating play. He's a British actor. He produced the Jew-Hating play about Rachel Corrie, a vicious anti-Semitic, anti-Israel hate play. And Vanessa Redgrave, Yimach Shmo V'Zichra, she's the one who condemns Zionism and condemns the existence of any Jewish state. By the way, Zionism just means that the Jews have their own homeland. Vanessa Redgrave is against the Jews having any state. She wants to destroy Israel. This Nazi Jew hater and Islamic terrorist supporter has spent decades doing everything she can to hurt Israel and the Jewish people, and yet the Hollywood Jews, of course, love her. All these people, by the way, are loved by the Hollywood Jews. All these vicious traitors. Susan Sarandon, an extreme left-wing supporter of the Arab Nazi Ralph Nader when he ran for president, and the Nazi Cindy Sheehan, who was also called for Israel's destruction. And Susan Sarandon supports all of these people. She raises money for them. She supports them. She defends them. She's also very popular in Hollywood. Among the Jews in Hollywood, even though she's a vicious anti-Semite. Cher, another extreme left-wing phony, who, by the way, has very close connections to Hillary Clinton, the other Jew hater. Sean Penn. Sean Penn's paternal grandparents were Jewish, by the way. Many people don't know that. He's not Jewish because his mother is not Jewish, but his father was actually a self-hating Jew. Sean Penn was married to Madonna, who has done so much to destroy Western culture and society. And I mean, just how could you even begin to describe all the damage that she's done? Sean Penn also, like Susan Sarandon, Sean Penn also supported the Arab Nazi Ralph Nader when he ran for president in 2000. He then supported the Nazi Denis Kucinich when he ran for president. I believe in 2008, I think he supported Denis Kucinich, but I know he was a Kucinich supporter. And Sean Penn visited Nazi Iran. Nazi Iran that openly says Israel should be destroyed, that they're going to wipe Israel off the map, that's building nuclear bombs to incinerate the Jewish people. Sean Penn visited Iran and he supports them. He also supports the communist dictators of Cuba and Venezuela. He's visited them too, and he supports them too. And of course, he's very popular among the Jews in Hollywood and among the Jewish organizations and the ADL and the UJA and the AGC and all the other organizations. They're very good. Roger Waters, one of the founders of Pink Floyd, which should be boycotted completely. He supports a boycott, a complete boycott of Israel, wants to destroy Israel. He supports the Hamas terrorists and supported the flotilla into Gaza to help the Hamas terrorists. He's just a vicious anti-Semite who uses caricatures of Jews right out of Nazi Germany with pictures of caricature Jews with Jewish stars on them to protest Israeli policies. The Anti-Defamation League, though, defends him. They say he's not anti-Semitic. Of course they're going to say that, because the Anti-Defamation League is anti-Semitic. So, that's just a brief review of the 8 glowing examples of Hollywood that was brought to us by Hollywood is a Dreamland from Marx and Lenin. Thank you, Hollywood is a Dreamland. And now we go to Yamashmo Wiener, our good friend, who writes, and I quote, "Dear Chaim, what was the internet like 20 years ago?" Unquote. 20 years ago, the internet was a much more difficult place to do anything, because 20 years ago is 1993. I was like 90% of people on the internet was with AOL at that time, because AOL had a monopoly pretty much on the internet. It wasn't like today, you know. In those days, you pretty much signed up with AOL. Over 90% of the people in the United States were signed up with AOL. And it was a nightmare. Things were going wrong all the time, and when things went wrong, if you tried to call the technical support at AOL, you would stay on the phone literally 3 or 4 hours waiting for a so-called technical person to help you, and then the technical person was an affirmative action moron who didn't help you at all after waiting 3 or 4 hours. That was the internet 20 years ago. It was a very difficult place to do anything, and you know, we tried to get around, and you wanted to try to do things on the internet anyway, but it was rough. It was very rough 20 years ago. Thank you, Yamashmo, to Wiener. And now we go to our good friend Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, "Shalom Chaim, what political party do you support in Israel and why?" Unquote. I do not support any of the political parties in Israel. I think they're all bad, and if I went to Israel, if I was able to make Aliyah, I would want to form my own political party, and maybe we'll form our own political party. Our Hebrew Forum people and our Hebrew supporters will form their own political party even while I'm here. Now, we have people in Israel, we have a movement in Israel, maybe they'll form a political party even in my absence. But we want to form our own political party. We don't like any of the existing parties. Thank you, Joe Gutfeld. And now we go to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, common sense, and logic, who writes, and I quote, "Why is the book called Bemidbar, by the way, it's Bemidbar, translated as the Book of Numbers and not the literal translation in the desert?" Unquote. By the way, Dr. Dan, when you wrote Bamidbar, that's what most Israelis would write. That's what most Jews would write. They translate it as they write Bamidbar, which means in the desert. But the actual name of the book is Sefer Bemidbar, which means in desert or in a desert. That's the actual original name of the book. But anyway, why is Bemidbar translated as the Book of Numbers into English? And the answer is, it is a poor translation. It is a misnomer. It should not be translated into the Book of Numbers. This is not something that Chazal, that the rabbis did. The rabbis and Chazal and the Talmud, they didn't know English. English as a language didn't exist when they wrote the Talmud. So this is not their doing. This was basically something that was translated by the Western world. It is not a correct translation, because one of the whole themes of Judaism is that people are not numbers. That's why over and over again they give us the names of people, sometimes more than once, sometimes several times. They give us the names of people and people in tribes and go through all types of detail in the Torah. To show us, one of the reasons is to show us that every person is a distinct human being with distinct characteristics. None of us are numbers. Totalitarian societies consider us to be numbers. They put numbers on our arms and branded us when we were in the Nazi concentration camps. And in the Soviet Union and other dictatorships, you're just a number. Under Barack Hussein Obama, with Obamacare, and with other socialist Bolshevik programs, you're just a number. Look at how government operates. Go to your nearest motor vehicle bureau. Go to the IRS. You're just a number to these people. You don't exist. You're a faceless, worthless number. But in Judaism, in the Torah, we're not allowed to think of people as numbers. The reason they probably refer to it as the Book of Numbers is because it starts out with the parasha, with the Torah portion, of how God commands Moses to do a census of the Jewish people, to count the Jewish people. But the census is only done after we have all types of detail about their names, their tribes, and other characteristics. Once we know their names and their numbers and their tribes and their characteristics, then you can count and do a census. But you're not supposed to count just to have a raw number count and not look at people as individuals. So in that respect, referring to it as the Book of Numbers is a misnomer. It's a mischaracterization and not a good translation. It should be In the Desert. It should be. That should be the name of the book in English. Thank you, Dr. Dan. And now we go to the great Yimach Shmo de Lewinsky, who writes, and I quote, "Do you think Helen Thomas Yimach Shma Vazichra wants AC right now? Do you think she is getting it?" Unquote. Oh, I there's no doubt that she wants it, but she's certainly not getting it. No, there's no air conditioning where Helen Thomas is. No. No. All these evil people will not get any air conditioning ever. And then Yimach Shmo de Lewinsky writes, "Please pray that Lewinsky will join her soon," unquote. Well, when Yimach Shmo de Lewinsky refers to Lewinsky, he's referring to Benjamin Netanyahu. Benjamin Netanyahu is certainly a terrible leader of Israel, and I certainly hope that he is removed as prime minister. He should not be prime minister of Israel. He should not have any political office. He should be disqualified from any leadership position because he has repeatedly lied to the people of Israel and betrayed all of his principles. And he's a dangerous person to have in that position. Very dangerous, because he always gives in to pressure. And the danger is that he's going to do that again now, when the pressure is for Israel to commit suicide, God forbid. Thank you, Yimach Shmo de Lewinsky. And now we go to the great Da Vinci, who writes, and I quote, "The supporters of homosexual marriages claim it will have zero impact on heterosexual marriages. What do you think?" Unquote. There's no question that it has a tremendous impact on heterosexual marriages. We've already seen that. All of these immoral things that have been accepted now in our society, look what it's led to. Much fewer people now get married. And I'm talking about heterosexuals. Much fewer people get married. 40% of all babies in the United States now are born, I think the figure is 40%, if I'm right. I think it's 40% of all babies now are born out of wedlock. Their parents are not married. And among blacks, it's 72%. At least 72%, according to the Census Bureau. So we have a tremendous crisis here that has gotten much worse. As we have degenerated, and as we have created more and more depraved, immoral standards, like homosexual marriage, it has affected all our morals, all across the board. When you have immoral practices in one area, it leads to immorality in all areas. You can't be partially pregnant. You don't have a situation like that. Immoral behavior, whether it's accepting homosexual marriage, or whether it's accepting pornography, or whether it's accepting aborting little babies, when you have immoral behavior, it's like gangrene. It spreads to the rest of the body, and it affects and destroys the morals throughout the body. The body, in this instance, being society as a whole. So homosexual marriages do have a big impact on heterosexual marriages. They hurt heterosexual marriages. They devastate the institution of marriage, and they turn the institution of marriage into a mockery. And that's one of the reasons why this should be fought against so vigorously. Thank you, Da Vinci. And now we go to our good friend Benjamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, "Please comment on the black kid whose parents taped him praying to Barack Hussein Obama. I guess blacks also worship blacks," unquote. Well, this is, of course, you know, just how insane things have gotten. It's not surprising. You know, Obama has been turned into a god, and Obama has been turned into the Messiah for many people. And, you know, I said many years ago that worshiping blacks is a new religion for many self-hating whites in the United States. And it is. I mean, there are white people in America who worship blacks. members of our forum, JTFers, might be wondering, how is that possible? How can you worship? That's who you're going to worship? You know, it's pretty unbelievable, but true. There are people who literally worship blacks. You see it on the television commercials. You see it in Hollywood. You see it in the movies and the television programs that are produced. They worship black people. You're not allowed to say anything bad about black people. All black people are good. Anyone who in any way criticizes any black is automatically a racist. You're allowed to say kikes and guineas and spics and mix and Polacks and all these other insults for every other ethnic group and every other race. But if you say nigger, you're not allowed. That word you're not allowed to say. It's like blasphemy. You're not allowed to say nigger. You have to say the N-word. Only blacks get that. No other group. No one says with kikes you have to say the K-word. You're not allowed to say the K-word. No one. So this is what we've come to. And now you have a president who's black. And they worship him. I mean, they worship him. Even though he's a catastrophe as a leader, he's an ugly, disgusting piece of garbage, a lying, immoral, filthy, stinking piece of socialist garbage, and this no good, racist, Jew-hating piece of Muslim filth in the White House has been turned into a god and a messiah by many people in America, including most blacks. Thank you, Binyamin Yisrael. And so I'm not surprised that one of their kids actually prays to him now. They actually pray to Barack Hussein Obama. I'm not surprised. And now we go to the great EB22, who writes, and I quote, "Which New York City mayoral race Republican candidate do you recommend in the September 10th primary? Joe LaHora, George McDonald, or John Katsimatidis. George McDonald and John Katsimatidis are not serious candidates. Katsimatidis is a billionaire, and he has supermarkets. He owns the Gristides, a supermarket chain. He's a billionaire. He knows how to make a lot of money, but he knows nothing about politics, and he's a clown as a candidate. And basically, George McDonald is not a serious candidate in any way. Joe LaHora, even though, you know, he's way too left-wing for me, that is whom I think we should be supporting. He's the only one who would have even a slim chance of being taken seriously as a candidate. I don't think he can win in New York City. But he would be a Giuliani-type Republican. He supports abortion, he supports homosexual marriage, he supports a lot of the things that are abominable to us. But he would be a good mayor in terms of crime, in terms of the budget, in terms of taxes. He would be, when I say good mayor, he would be better than any of the left-wing Democrats who are proposing things that would destroy the city. He would be like Giuliani, similar to Giuliani. And so I think that he's the only candidate that we could even take seriously, and so I think people should support Joe LaHora. And if he wins the Republican primary, as I hope that he does, I am going to vote for Joe LaHora in November. I'm going to hold my nose and vote for him, even though, again, on the issues of abortion and gay marriage and these other social issues, you know, I don't like him. But I know that at least, I know that lives will be saved in terms of crime, violent crime, and I know that in terms of the future of the city and the economy and the budget, that he would be better for New York than any of the Democrats running. So I'm supporting Joe LaHora. Thank you, EP22. And now we go to our friend Russian Leo 777, who writes, and I quote, "One, what is the best possible scenario we can hope for in Egypt?" Unquote. "We can hope that there'd be a full-scale civil war and they all kill each other and destroy the Egyptian economy and that there's complete chaos and that Egypt is a nation in ruins. That's the best possible scenario. The more they kill each other, the more chaos, the more catastrophe that there is in Egypt, the better it is for the rest of the world, because the Egyptians are vicious, vicious, hateful Muslim fanatics. And even if they're not religious Muslims, they have this hatred and envy toward the Western world. certainly toward Jews and Christians. They despise Jews, they despise Christians, they despise Israel, they despise America. So the weaker Egypt is and the worse off Egypt is, the better we all are. And that's why all U.S. aid to Egypt should be cut immediately. Russian Leo now writes, and I quote, "Two, how can we force Muslims to leave the U.S.?" Unquote. Well, you'd have to start out with the President of the United States. That's the first Muslim you've got to get to leave. That's going to be very difficult to do. But we have to educate Americans. What we have to do is educate Americans about the nature of Islam and about what Muslims stand for. And if we educate the American people and wake the American people up, you will have less of this terrible phenomenon, this nightmarish phenomenon that I see in Queens, by the way. I see this in Queens, where entire neighborhoods are being taken over by Muslims. I see huge numbers of Muslims all moving in all over Queens, in Brooklyn. I mean, it's huge. I mean, they're coming in droves. Anyone who lives in New York City can tell you that. You see it all over the place here. And that's a very dangerous situation. We're going to have the same catastrophe that we have in Europe. In the United States, we're headed toward the nightmare that they have in Europe. So we got to wake people up. Once we wake people up, then hopefully we'll get people to want to implement immigration policies and border policies that will be different. Thank you, Russian Leo. And now we go to the great, where was Chris Hansen in the 7th century? Who writes, and I quote, if blank was nominated, could he get elected? And then we have three names here. If Ted Cruz was nominated, could he get elected? I hope so. I like Ted Cruz so far. I don't know for sure. Maybe he's going to disappoint me like many politicians have done. I mean, we've gotten sold out by a lot of people. And I want to learn more about him. But he seems to be pretty aggressive and seems to be willing to fight Hillary Clinton. If he was a nominee, I think at least Hillary Clinton would have a real fight on her hands. I think he would go after her aggressively. Is America in a situation where now you have a left-wing majority of voters already, and so a real Republican can't win anymore? I don't know. But the only way to find out would be to nominate a real conservative. And so far, Ted Cruz has been running like a real conservative. And then, if Rand Paul was nominated, could he get elected? Probably not. And I wouldn't want him to get elected anyway. I think he would be a disaster. And finally, if Rick Santorum was nominated, could he get elected? Probably not. I like Rick Santorum. I wouldn't mind having him as president. I happen to like Rick Santorum. But he makes statements and runs campaigns in a way that it just wasn't very professional. His campaign was not well run. In 2012, he had a chance for a while there to actually get the nomination, and he blew it. I mean, he made all types of statements about contraceptives, about other things. I mean, he went off on a wild goose chase here after things that are just not acceptable to the vast majority of American voters. And he got, you know, he you have to stay on message when you're a candidate. You have to be very disciplined, and you got to stay on message. And he just went off, basically, you know, because he's a very devout Catholic, so he was basically preaching against contraceptives. 95% of the American people use contraceptives. 95% of the American people who are married use contraceptives. I mean, if you make it sound like you're going to take people's contraceptives away, you gave the Democrats an issue which makes it almost impossible for you to get elected. So he made some serious mistakes in the campaign. And I don't think he has a chance of getting the nomination, and I don't think he has a chance of getting elected. Even though I like him, I like Rick Santorum, but I don't think he would have a chance. And now, where was Chris Hansen in the 7th century? Writes, and I quote, "Two, what does the GOP have to change to expand its voter base?" Unquote. That's a great question. I think the GOP has to be loyal to their principles, and the GOP has to convince the roughly, I don't know, 60-65% of American voters that are white, maybe it's more because some of the non-white voters are not citizens. So maybe it's two-thirds of the American voters that are white. They have to overwhelmingly be convinced to support the Republican Party and to oppose the Democrats. That's the challenge. How do you convince them to do that? By mimicking the Democrats? By being a carbon copy of the Democrats? By selling out your principles? No. You've got to remain true to your principles, and you're going to have to convince people that the conservative Republican approach, real conservatism, though, I'm talking about real conservatism. I'm not talking about George W. Bush, and I'm not talking about these other sellouts, John McCain and Chris Christie. I'm not talking about them. You have to convince the American people that a real conservative in the White House would be very good for the country and would be just what the nation needs. If you can somehow convince the voters to give you a chance to implement real conservative policies, if you can say, take a chance on us, give us a chance, you did it for Ronald Reagan and look at the great results, we can do it again. If you can convince the American people of that, somehow convince a majority of the voters of that, that's the hope you have of getting into office, and then when you get into office, actually implementing the change that would make people want to support the Republicans again. Thank you. Where was Chris Hansen in the 7th century? Great questions. And now we go to our good friend Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, in prison, is solitary confinement better and safer than being in general population, unquote? It definitely is not better. It is much worse. People very much want to avoid solitary confinement, being in what they call the hole in prison. I mean, no sane person wants to be in solitary confinement. It is very, very difficult. The conditions there are terrible. You go crazy there. I mean, I thank God because I'm religious and because of, you know, various other things. I mean, I was able to actually stay there for months. They punished me. They put me there for months, and I was actually in solitary confinement for months when I was in prison. But I survived it. The other people, by the way, committed suicide. People hang themselves sometimes in solitary confinement. People sometimes actually commit suicide. They can't take it. They go crazy. So no, I think the conditions are much worse. Is it safer? Maybe it's safer. I guess maybe it's safer. But you know, the conditions are so bad, you go absolutely nuts. So people in prison, almost all people, 95% I would say of the people in prison would prefer to be in general population, don't want to be in solitary for that reason. Because the conditions in solitary, we are all alone, and it's dark, and it's, you know, terrible, and it smells, you know, it's dirty, it's dark, it smells. It's just, you know, you don't have the freedom to take showers when you want. You don't have the freedom, you know, to do anything that you want. I mean, it's a very, very difficult situation to be like that. Just imagine 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You're supposed to be able to get 1 hour. You're supposed to be able to get 1 hour of what they call recreation, where they put you in another place outside, also inside a fenced. You know, you're in another fence surrounding. I mean, it's horrible. You're supposed to get 1 hour of recreation 5 times a week, where they take you out of your cell and they put you in another bigger cell for 1 hour. Terrible. No, it's definitely better in general population. Thank you, Maimonides. And now, Wolf, who I think Wolf is not new to our forum, but welcome anyway, because I see one post. So welcome anyway. Wolf writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, what is your opinion on the death penalty? If you're against it, what happens to evil people after they die? Unquote. Now, I'm definitely in favor of the death penalty. I'm very much in favor of it. Evil people, after they die, some of them just die in the grave. In other words, they're sent. First of all, everybody first has Yom HaDin, a day of judgment. Every human being will go before their creator and be judged. And their whole life will flash before their eyes, and they'll see their whole life in front of them. And they'll have an understanding of all the things they did wrong. Some of them will be sentenced to just dying immediately. In other words, they'll just disappear as if they never were born. They die in the grave and they disappear as if they were never born. Some of them, that will be the punishment for some. Others will go through a period of punishment, torture and punishment, for the terrible things they've done. Some people who did certain things that are evil, but also have a lot of merit in their lives, may go through a period of punishment. This is a third category of people. They'll go through a period of punishment. And then after the period of punishment, their souls are cleansed, and then they will join the good people and have a place in the next world. So there are all types of punishments. I mean, I just gave you three different categories. One is that you die immediately after the judgment, and you just disappear. Your soul disappears, and it's as if you never existed. You just disappear. That's one group of people. The second group of people, again, has punishment, and this varies. How long the punishment goes on when people are in what's called hell. How long this goes on, how long the punishment goes on, varies. It says, we're taught that people are punished midah keneged midah, measure for measure. So in other words, everybody's judgment is different. You could have one person who is punished in hell for 1 year. You could have another person who's punished in hell for 1,000 years. You could have another person who's punished in hell forever. So they're different categories, and they're even different levels of hell. Of the degrees of punishment. So that's the second group of people with vast differences of what type of punishment they'll receive. And again, we don't know if it's physical punishment. We don't know if it's mental, if it's just mental punishment because people are in the spiritual world. Maybe it's just mental punishment for people in the spiritual world. You know, mental punishment can be more brutal than physical punishment. It can be more painful than physical punishment. So we don't know. We don't know exactly what happens or exactly how it happens. And then the third category, the third group of people, again, are people, this is the group that's probably in the best situation. This is a group of people who've done evil things, but at the same time, and just have to have their souls cleansed of the evil deeds, but at the same time have also done a lot of good things. So they will spend a certain amount of time being punished. And then after their souls are cleansed as a result of the punishment, as a result of the torment that they go through, after their souls are cleansed for the evil things they've done to other people or just evil in general, because of the good things, the many good things they have in their lives, they will eventually join the good people after their souls are cleansed. And again, the period of time in which they have to go through this varies from person to person. I hope that answers it in general. That is the Jewish view. Thank you, Wolf. And now we go to the great Imaknik, who writes, and I quote, "What are some of the differences between biblical and modern Hebrew? If one learns modern Hebrew, would they easily understand the biblical version?" Unquote. If one learns modern Hebrew, they would understand the biblical version. I wouldn't say easily, because there are words in ancient Hebrew that just aren't used anymore. I mean, thousands of years, obviously, the language changed. It's the same language. Biblical Hebrew and modern Hebrew are the same Hebrew, the same language. Except after thousands of years, there have been changes in the expressions, even some of the words that were used in biblical times thousands of years ago are not used anymore. And similarly, some of the words that are used in modern words that are used weren't used in biblical Hebrew. Obviously, you're not going to have in biblical Hebrew someone speaking about the molekulot. Molekulot in Hebrew means molecules, or atomim, or atoms, because the world didn't have that. Human beings had not achieved that knowledge yet. God gave human beings the ability to eventually discover those things, but at that time people didn't have the knowledge to understand those things. So things like chashmal, electricity, and all types of concepts that we have in the modern world didn't exist in biblical times. So there are words that have changed over the years, after thousands of years. But you still would understand, yes, someone who understands modern Hebrew, has a good understanding, a fluent understanding of modern Hebrew, can read the Bible in biblical Hebrew and comprehend it. Even though they won't understand a word here, a word there, they may not understand certain concepts. They probably will need rabbinic. They probably will need the assistance of the oral law, the Mishnah, and the Talmud to understand the meanings Because the Bible, it doesn't have simple meaning. The Bible has deeper meanings. To understand the deeper meanings, they have to study the Mishnah, they have to study the Gemara, the Talmud. But just to understand the general linguistic meaning of a sentence, yes, they would have a general understanding of that if they knew modern Hebrew. Thank you, Imaknik. Great question. And now we go to the great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, "Does the U.S. support the Muslim Brotherhood and its affiliates and want to see them gain control of Egypt and throughout the Middle East?" And then it says, "Egyptian expectations to come." That I'm not sure exactly what you mean. The second part, maybe you were trying to write something else and got cut off in the middle of the sentence. But the question about the Muslim Brotherhood. I think that the Obama administration just supports Islam and Muslims. I don't know if they specifically support the Muslim Brotherhood. I think Obama did support the Muslim Brotherhood coming to power when they were protesting against Mubarak. I mean, he clearly supported them and he wanted to give them as much assistance as possible. Does he support them now? I think that Obama just generally supports the Muslim world. And let's not... It is completely untrue to suggest that the Muslim Brotherhood is worse than the current Egyptian government, or that one group of Muslims is better than the other group. In the end, they will all be against the United States and Israel. They're all going to be against us in the end. Remember, Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda terrorists, fought with the United States against the Soviets in Afghanistan. They were allies of the United States. So let's not forget that. That's how quickly things can change in the Muslim world, and that is exactly what you have now in Egypt. All sides in Egypt are our enemies. And Obama, being a Muslim, wants the Muslim world to gain power and gain control. He wants more power for the Muslim world and to support and justify and legitimize and strengthen the Muslim world as much as possible while he's in office. Thank you, Tag Mechir Tzedek. And now, the great Chicago Jew writes, and I quote, "Just got back home to Chicago. It was a pleasure to meet you, your family, and my fellow JTFers last Thursday. I had a real nice time," unquote. Chicago Jew, it was a pleasure and a privilege to meet with you. I was very, very happy to meet with you. We all enjoyed meeting you. It was just great seeing you, Chicago Jew. Absolutely great seeing you. God bless you. And now we go to the great Papercut, who writes, and I quote, "Chaim, what can we do to start JTF groups all across America, and how do we do it? Also, would you be opposed to us arming ourselves like militias?" Okay, let's answer those one at a time. Starting JTF groups, you can start a JTF group if you find people in your community or people close enough to you that would like to start a chapter. That would be good. You can do that. If you want to get together, you know, and meet, like we do here in New York, we meet once a month. That would be good. That's a good idea. If you want to just be active on the internet and start groups on the internet that are active, that's also a good idea. I mean, just promote JTF and push this on the internet, that's also good. The internet is the wave of the future. So having things that are strong on the internet and having a big movement on the internet can be very important. You know, many people say Obama got elected to the presidency mainly through the internet. You know, that was the thing that really pushed him over the top, that he had a huge advantage on the internet, and I think there's some truth to that. So the internet is a very powerful vehicle. But, you know, doing things in person and meeting in person, having local chapters in person are also, that's also good. It's also good. If you can do it, if you can start it, if you can find other people that are willing to be part of it, that would be great. That would be great. As far as arming ourselves like militias, I am in favor of people legally arming themselves. I'm against people acquiring illegal firearms or doing anything that's against the law. That's just not worth it. It's not that I respect the anti-gun laws in places like New York. I think the anti-gun laws in places like New York are terrible, and I would repeal all of them. But I think that it's not worth breaking the law. In most parts of the country, in most parts of the United States, you can acquire firearms legally. And I do think people should do so. I think, first of all, they should train. I think they should join either the NRA or other organizations who have clubs where they teach you how to use firearms. So people should be trained. And people should have, I think people should be armed. I think people should have firearms. Absolutely. If it's, as long as it's legal, as long as all the firearms are legal and no laws are being broken, I think that it's very healthy to be armed. I think it's good and healthy, and I think it's wise. Thank you, Papercut. And now we go to the great Confederate Kahanist, who writes, and I quote, "Dear Chaim, please discuss how FDR handled World War II. Thanks and God bless," unquote. Great question. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, Yimach Shmo V'Zichro Shem Reshaim Birkav, did the worst thing that anybody could ever do in World War II, and that is that he deliberately wanted 6 million Jews to be murdered. He wanted as many Jews to be murdered as possible. So we have to start out with that terrible crime that he committed. He did everything possible to make sure that the Jews would be murdered. Everything possible to signal to the Nazis that they would get away with murdering the Jews. He bombed every single target in Germany. The American and British air forces had complete mastery over the skies of Europe. They had defeated the German air force decisively because Jewish scientists gave them the technology to build aircraft and to build to mass produce planes, tens of thousands of planes, with the best technology and the best weaponry and the best firepower. So the American and British air forces defeated the German air force decisively. And so for most of the war, the United States and Britain had complete mastery over the skies in Europe and could bomb anything they wanted. And they bombed almost every possible target in Germany and throughout Europe, except for the Nazi concentration camps that were murdering the Jews, and except for the rail lines that were leading to the death camps. All the other roads in Germany they were bombing. Everything else they were bombing and destroying, but the roads and the rail lines leading the Jews to the concentration camps, that's the one thing that they deliberately left untouched. And in fact, the Germans even used that to transport weapons, and they used because they saw that this is the one thing. The Americans and the British do not want to stop them from murdering the Jews. They want to make it as easy as possible for them to murder the Jews. That was FDR's policy, and it was Winston Churchill's policy. So that crime was the worst crime that anybody could ever commit. That's the first thing we have to mention about FDR and World War II. Secondly, the United States was not well prepared enough for World War II. Eventually, there was a vote on the draft, and it passed by just one person, but Roosevelt did not properly prepare the United States for World War II. The United States could have been better prepared. The American people should have been better prepared. It was not executed properly before the war, before the United States was attacked at Pearl Harbor, and before Germany and Italy declared war on America. After Pearl Harbor, Germany and Italy declared war on the United States. Before that happened, the United States should have been much better prepared, and was not. And then during the war itself, again, I think there are things that could have been done differently, but I think overall, the crime that was committed against millions of Jews is an unforgivable crime. It's a stain that lives on forever. And the fact that there was not proper preparation before the war, I think those are the two things that really demonstrate that FDR did not handle World War II the way he should have. Thank you, Confederate Kahanist. Let me just do one other thing here. I've got to do that up here. Okay. I certainly enjoy doing the program this week, and I love speaking to our great fellow JTFers. Until next week, shalom.